You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 26th of September. On the programme today, we discuss the UAE's foreign policy priorities after the country's Ministry of State for International Cooperation, Reem Al-Hashmi, called for building bridges in the Middle East at the United Nations General Assembly. We also cross live to Beirut as the banks reopened. Journalist Wael Talib talked us through the latest in Lebanon's banking crisis. Plus, as the Dubai Metaverse Assembly at the Museum of the Future is due to start this week, its director Hamad Al-Shirawi joined us to explain why it's happening in real life. Meanwhile, the government's announced its latest flu jab campaign. We were joined by Dr. Nada Al-Marzouki, the director of the Department of Public Health and Prevention at the Ministry of Health. And NASA is planning to smash a spacecraft into an asteroid. We found out why with one of the scientists involved.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
NASA is planning to smash a spacecraft into an asteroid called Dimorphos tonight. Yes, really. It's not the plot of a movie. They're actually going to do it. It's called The Dart, and it's worth $330 million. And it's due to slam head-on into the asteroid about 11 kilometres above the Indian Ocean at around 3 a.m. our time, Dubai time. The impact at nearly 7 kilometres a second will obliterate the half-ton probe. And apparently it's all in the name of planetary defence. Joining us now to explain why is one of the NASA Dart investigation team, Professor Alan Fitzsimmons, who's an astronomer at Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland. He joins me now on Microsoft Teams. Hello there, Professor Fitzsimmons. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well. Thank you very much. Can I just say one thing, just so that none of your viewers and listeners are worried? The impact will occur 11 million kilometres above the Earth, not 11. So we're not doing it, you know, leaving it quite so late. It's not like the Hollywood movies.
Oh, I wish it was 11 metres. But that is a very important point. And I'm very pleased that you raised that, because clearly I was getting a bit overexcited there. There was an M next to the 11. I just ignored it and just said 11 kilometres. Well, that is very exciting and less, you know, threatening, which is a good thing. But talk me through exactly what is going to happen and why it's going to happen, because it sounds like a bit of a waste of money, but I'm sure that there is thinking behind the plan.
Well, it's let's go to the why first, because I think everybody is now familiar from Hollywood and TV and sci-fi about the idea of asteroids hitting the Earth, causing devastation, although in Hollywood it only takes 2 hours and at the end the hero saves everything. Well, in real life, asteroids do hit our planet. We know a big one hit us 66 million years ago, killed off the dinosaurs. If we go through to the modern era, we had only a small asteroid 50 meters across hit Tunguska in Russia in 1908, which devastated 2,000 square kilometers of forest. And then just 9 years ago, the Russian city of Chelyabinsk suffered an impact of a very small asteroid, only 18 meters across, and that injured 1,600 people. Now, big asteroids don't hit us that often, but they have done in the past. They will do in the future. And so if you want to defend the Earth from an asteroid impact, you don't wait until you see one coming. You test your technology and you test your deflection techniques before you have to do it in earnest. And that's the purpose of the DART mission.
So you're going to try to deflect the asteroid, to deflect Dimorphos.
That's right. Now, in a real planetary defence scenario, we'd be trying to change the orbit of an asteroid about the sun so that at some point in the future, instead of meeting the Earth, it would sail safely by. With Dimorphos, we're not changing its orbit about the sun because it's in orbit about another asteroid. So we're going to be very safe here. And what we're going to do is change the orbit of Dimorphos about its parent asteroid, Didymos. And we'll be able to measure that deflection from Earth and see how effective the DART probe was.
It still sounds like the plot of a Hollywood movie. It really does. I mean, do you reckon it's possible? Does NASA, you're part of the team. Do you think it's going to work?
We think it's going to work. We think the biggest unknown is how well it's going to work. But look, this is why DART stands for Double Asteroid Redirection Test. We've never done this before. No matter all the Hollywood movies and TV shows that you see, we have never tried to move an asteroid, deflect it onto a different path. And this is such a serious concern in the future, because we know we will be hit by asteroids in the future, it's just a matter of when, then we want to test and we want to check our technology can do it. So that's why DART is performing this noble self-sacrifice this evening.
Are you speeding it up beforehand so that it hits at ultimate impact?
Well, we do have an ion engine on board, and that was provided a little bit of extra thrust to us. But primarily, the velocity is coming from the fact that we put DART in an orbit about the sun, and the asteroid is on its own orbit about the sun as they go around the sun. So when they close together, their relative velocity will be just over 6 kilometers per second. That's over 14,000 miles an hour. And that's what gives us the energy to move the asteroid.
Oh, that's interesting. So the orbit is almost providing you with that extraordinary speed and velocity. Okay, so how about the option that we have in the movie Armageddon, where instead of trying to deflect the asteroid, you blow it up?
Well, you've got to be careful, we believe, in the science community of thinking about using nuclear devices in space. And of course, there's an international ban on the use of nuclear weapons in space. And so for small asteroids like Dimorphos, which could still wipe out a city or a small state if they landed on Earth, we believe we should be able to deflect that asteroid with a kinetic impactor like DART if we have enough warning. Now, larger asteroids, say a kilometre across or even 10 kilometres across, the size of the dinosaur killer 66 million years ago, DART really wouldn't be enough and we'd have to do something else. Maybe multiple DART missions, or there we might consider some kind of blast technology using a nuclear weapon. The good news is that over the past 20 or 30 years, astronomers have been surveying the solar system to try to find these large asteroids that could threaten us in the future. We've found, we believe, over 95% of them now, and none of them are coming near our planet in the next 100 or 200 years.
That is immensely good news. Is it possible that you've missed any, that some have slipped the net, because maybe they're too small but could still have a big impact?
Well, the big ones, the 1 kilometre and above asteroids, those we believe there's probably still a handful left to discover. But we right now are building a new telescope in Chile, in South America, that over the next 10 years should sweep the rest of those up. But the smaller objects like Dimorphos, about the size of Dimorphos, where we're going tonight, these are much harder to find. And we've probably found, well, we know, actually, we've found less than half of those so far. So although on average, they only hit once every thousands of years or every tens of thousands of years, objects that size, there could be one that's going to hit us in the next 100 years. We haven't just found it yet. So DART is a mission that allows us to prepare ourselves for that eventuality.
Okay, so it all happens at 3 a.m. our time, midnight UK time. And will you be sitting there on tenterhooks waiting to see what happens?
I'll be doing many things. So, yes, I'll be watching with everybody else the live stream. The images will be coming down once per second from the DART spacecraft. And we're hoping to see this asteroid get very big very quickly in the windscreen before it hits. But also, I'm one of a team of over 200 scientists from around the world, from 28 countries, who are using telescopes around the world to monitor this from Earth. And we'll be seeing from Earth exactly what the effects of the DART impact are. Because, again, it's a test. We're not quite sure. We're waiting to see.
Professor Fitzsimmons, I really hope we can talk to you as well tomorrow. Thank you so much for your time. Professor Alan Fitzsimmons, an astronomer at Queen's University of Belfast in Northern Ireland. He's also part of the NASA DART investigation team. Now, over the weekend, the UAE outlined its foreign policy priorities in a speech at the United Nations General Assembly.
I now give the floor to Her Excellency Reem Ibrahim Al Hassimi, Minister of State for International Cooperation of the United Arab Emirates.
Speaking in front of the world's leaders, nearly all 193 of them, of course, Russia and China aren't present this year. The UAE Minister of State for International Cooperation, Reem Al Hashmi, said the UAE's priorities focused on peace and partnerships.
At the precipice of a new era for the world.
Do you know, I'm going to stop it there because I want to explain something. This is the first time a UAE woman has delivered a speech for the Emirates at the UN General Assembly. But sadly, the translator was a man, so it slightly loses its power in translation. So the voice you're going to hear now is not actually Reem Al Hashmi. It is the translator. So that might explain. But it is a real pity that on this moment of real importance for the UAE, when a woman addressed the nation, the world, that they had a male translator. But never mind, we have to let it go. And what is important is what Reem Al Hashmi said.
At the precipice of a new era for the world order, the UAE has chosen to embrace peace, recovery and prosperity within an international system that is supported by an open and robust network of partnerships. Through this framework, we will launch new pathways for cooperation in fields of economics, sustainable development, advanced technology, and scientific research. This is the underlying premise that guides my country's foreign policy, governs our bilateral and multilateral engagements, and also inspires our membership throughout our Security Council term.
Yes, now core themes in the speech were strengthening stability, ending double standards in implementing international law and easing Middle East conflicts. Now, as mentioned just there, the UAE is currently holding a seat on the Security Council for a 2-year term. It will also serve as its president in June 2023. Now, foreign policy analysts suggest that this means that the UAE's global standing has never been stronger. And earlier, we spoke to geopolitics expert Mahin Rizvi Ahmed. She's a senior lecturer in international relations at Middlesex University in Dubai. And she suggested that the UAE has really maximised on its temporary position on that Security Council.
If you look at kind of the signature events that they were really focusing on, it was about women's economic inclusion, but it was also about issues like climate finance for sustaining international peace and security, and recognizing the need to kind of preempt, to rebuild structures and to make countries more resilient to climate change. And of course, the third key thing was really focusing on building relations, improving relations between the United Nations and the League of Arab States. And one more thing that I would like to highlight is that, especially in light of the Abraham Accords, you've seen the fact that as a member of the Security Council this year, the UAE has again brought up the issue of the Palestinian question, focusing on the security situation and recognizing the fact that the only way to end the cycle of violence is to reach a comprehensive, just and peaceful solution to the Palestinian issues.
Now, Mahin also outlined the UAE's current foreign policy strategy.
A lot of the focus is now on peace and dialogue and kind of rapprochement with some of the neighbors, but especially, for example, in the case of Iran. And I think it's a case of the UAE recognizing the fact that peace and dialogue and diplomacy is really the key forward, especially in light of course, the Abraham Accords that took place in 2020, but also in light of the Al-Ula Agreement, which restored relations with Qatar in 2021. So I think it's really a case of trying to recognize the fact that kind of diplomacy and dialogue is going to have an impact economically as well, and is going to create more stability in the region. And I think that's very, very important. And that shift has really been seen in the last year or so. And it ties in very much with the principles of the 50 that came through last year.
Humanitarian aid also plays a notable role in the UAE's strategic diplomacy. Mahin said the massive donations made by the Emirates help to improve the country's global standing.
That's very much part of its foreign policy. It's very much part of its kind of emerging as a leader, not just in the region, but globally as well. It's had a multi-pronged approach. So a lot of it is focused on developmental aid, infrastructure in other countries in the Middle East, for example, in the broader Arab world, so whether it's Egypt or Jordan. But a lot of it is, for example, humanitarian assistance in the case of Yemen, in the case of Syria. But more recently, for example, in the case of the Pakistani floods, the UAE has been absolutely pivotal in terms of providing assistance. You can look at, for example, International Humanitarian City, which is actually the largest humanitarian hub in the world, where, you know, within 8 hours, 2/3 of the world's population can be reached. So that sort of infrastructure, the fact that the world's biggest NGOs and international organizations, UN World Food Programme, all based here in the UAE, really makes it the center of humanitarian assistance. And the UAE also continues to be one of the largest providers of overseas development assistance as well.
Maheen also pointed out that much of the UAE's foreign policy is actually rooted in its domestic policy.
A lot of this is very much about really recognizing the diversity within their own population and respecting that kind of inclusivity and diversity. And I think that comes through very clearly in terms of both their foreign policy, in terms of their economic decisions, in terms of their relations with not just the neighbors directly around them, but in the region as well.
Geopolitics expert Maheen Rizvi Ahmed there. She's a senior lecturer in international relations at Middlesex University right here in Dubai. Fascinating stuff. Really interesting to see how the UAE has outlined its foreign policy in so much detail there. Obviously, if you want to read a little bit more about it, do check out the ARN News Centre's website and app. We're going to go a little bit early with our sports bulletin today. Mohamed Suleiman, my goodness me, joins me in the studio. He was able to come in early because he's just finished his morning meeting with the Business Breakfast team. What's going to be on the programme tomorrow? Any spoilers?
You're going to have to tune in at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning to find out, Georgia. No, but we have a big focus, of course, on the continuing drop of the pound.
I know. I've sent every...
Absolutely crazy. Yeah,
We've sent every penny we have back to the UK to pay off our mortgage there. Because this is 20% lift, right?
Correct.
Like, it's a big deal. It makes a big difference, especially with interest rates going up. There's a real drive, I think, for Brits. And frankly, anyone who owns property with a mortgage in the UK.
It's going to be huge. Yeah, we had a lot of messages back this morning, very, very similar sentiments to what you were saying, that this is the best time to sort of just pay off your mortgage if you
don't
have one.
There will be no shopping in Dubai over the next month because there is no money left for me in Dubai.
It's useful for us, though, because I'm actually travelling to the UK next week.
Well, and I'm going as well, to look at schools. So, yes, so it's
we're
that
be
will
laughing.
Feel cheap and cheerful.
Exactly.
I'll be in boots stocking up on air conditioner. Which, by the way, is half the price in England than it is here.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have long hair. It matters. That's way too much information. Right, let's move on to the sports news. Because let's start with athletics. My goodness me, you surprised us on this Monday morning. But we have a new marathon world record.
We do. An incredible moment yesterday over in Germany. Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya broke his own men's marathon world record at last night's race in Berlin. Georgia, how long or how many kilometers is a marathon?
It's 26 miles.
Yes, very good. 26.2 miles or 42.195 kilometers. So
that's
a marathon is a long...
silly number.
There you go. Yeah. So here's the moment when Eliud Kipchoge crossed the finish line and broke his own world record.
The double Olympic champion is the greatest marathon runner we have ever seen in the history of the event. He's going to get inside the world record. It won't be by a minute, but it will be an appreciable chunk. He has done it again. This is superhuman. This is road running from a different planet here in Berlin in 2022. Eliud Kipchoge smiles for the last time. Let's keep an eye on the clock, just outside 2:01. Eliud Kipchoge is a history maker in Berlin yet again. He has done it.
I mean, superhuman. I think that commentator put it right. That's the only word to describe Eliud Kipchoge. 37 years old, also a double Olympic champion. He crossed the line in a time of 2 hours, 1 minute, and 9 seconds. That's 30 seconds.
That's absolutely staggering.
I mean, just the fact that he's able to break his own record in terms of how long it takes him to finish a marathon. So 30 seconds better than his previous best, which was 4 years ago. But let's hear from the man himself. Let's hear from Eliud Kipchoge speaking after his record-breaking feat.
Still more in my legs, are still more. My mind is still actually thinking-wise. still moving. The body actually still absorbing the trainings and racing.
That was Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya. An incredible performance from him at 37 years old. Breaks his own world record in the marathon. He is the new world record holder.
Amazing. Apologies for the gremlins in the system. That's there. Okay. Let's move on to cricket, because not one, not two, but three big T20 matches last night. Let's start with India versus Australia.
Yes, so we had the third and final T20 between India and Australia last night. The series was tied 1-1 going into this one, which means there was everything to play for over in Hyderabad. And in the end, it was India who came out on top by 6 wickets. With just one ball remaining to win this series. So Australia batted first. They posted 186 for 7 in their 20 overs, half centuries from Cameron Green and Tim David. In reply, India actually lost their two openers very quickly early on in their chase, but Virat Kohli and Surya Kumar Yadav put on a partnership of 104 runs to get the hosts back on track. Surya Kumar Yadav made 69, Virat Kohli made 63. I think India will be very relieved to see Virat Kohli back in form. I mean, he did make a century against Afghanistan in the Asia Cup earlier this month, but that was against Afghanistan. This was against a high quality Australian attack in a high pressure match as well. So 63 from Virat Kohli. He got out in the end though, but in the end it was Hardik Pandya who hit the winning runs, with India needing 4 runs to win off 2 balls. Let's hear from India captain Rohit Sharma speaking about Surya Kumar Yadav's incredible innings earlier on in the match.
Every time I see him, he's taken his game a notch higher, which is a good sign as a player. Whenever you see that, you can raise the level of your skills, of what the team expect from you, it's always a good sign. And I can see that in Surya. Every game that I see of his, every game that he plays, he seems to be getting better and better every time he plays.
He's a very special batsman, Surya Kumar Yadav. The thing about him that makes him different is that he scores runs all around the pitch, right? He's not a one-dimensional player. He scores literally runs everywhere around the field. So he's back and
forth. So you never
as well.
Know where he's going to hit.
Exactly, yeah.
So the fielders can't be prepped.
Yeah, exactly. And one second he's hitting the ball straight, the next second he can hit the same ball literally behind him, because he moves around in the crease a lot as well. So he's a very, very special player. So India take that series 2-1. They now get ready to host South Africa for a 3-match T20 series, which gets underway in Nagpur on Wednesday.
Okay, Pakistan and England were also in action. What happened there?
Yeah, an absolutely thrilling finish to this one over in Karachi last night. It was the 4th of 7 T20 matches between Pakistan and England. England went into this one with a 2-1 series lead. So Pakistan batted first and posted 166 for 4 in reply. England lost a flurry of early wickets but got back on track with some big hitting in the end. But in the end, it went down to the last over. They needed 4 runs to win, 1 wicket in hand, 6 balls left, and this happened.
Oh, should be run out. Must be run out. Pakistan! Pakistan have levelled the series 2-2. And pandemonium has broken out here at the National Stadium. That was as tense, that was as balmy a finish as you're going to get in a T20 game. Oh my goodness.
As barmy a finish as you're going to see. And that's sort of what makes T20 cricket so much fun, right? You just don't know what's going to happen. At one stage, it looked like Pakistan were going to coast to victory. And then Liam Dawson hit some crazy runs at the end of the innings. And then it looked like England were going to coast to victory. And then in the end, it was Pakistan who just squeaked that one there with that run out at the end. So Pakistan edged past England by 3 runs. They leveled that T20 series 2-2 with 3 matches to play. Let's hear from England captain Moeen Ali speaking after last night's loss.
With 9 runs, with 3 wickets, still you feel like you should win that game, but it can happen. Pressure happens, and I actually thought they bowled really, really well. Both teams bowled really well tonight on that wicket, and they managed to get over the line.
So 2-2 in that one. The next match gets underway in Lahore on Wednesday.
More cricket, because there was T20 action right here in the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah, we'll keep this one quick, because it was Bangladesh taking on the UAE in the first of 2 T20s here in Dubai. Bangladesh batted first. They made 158 for 5 in reply. The UAE got close. They were bowled out for 151 in the final over. So the UAE losing by 7 runs in Dubai. One more match to go in that series, and that gets underway tomorrow. Yeah, 6 p.m. tomorrow here at the Dubai Sports City. It'll be Bangladesh taking on the UAE in the second T20.
Fantastic. Finally, let's talk golf. We've got about a minute to go. We had the conclusion of the President's Cup last night over in North Carolina. Another big win for the United States?
Yes, correct. Let's see if you remember, Georgia, who is the President's Cup between? We know the Ryder Cup is between the USA and Europe. The President's Cup is between the USA and
the rest of the world.
Oh, very good. Yeah, so the international team minus Europe.
Do you know, we ought to do a sports quiz.
We should,
because they do the news quiz and it's hilarious.
Yeah, so Serena gives the boys and Brandy a news quiz at the end of every week.
But they're funnier than me. It might not work. We have to get Andrew in.
Yeah, we've got to get Andrew in. And we have we should like a two versus one on a sports quiz.
But Andrew's our new producer, by the way, if you haven't picked his name up. But Andrew's our new producer.
Yes, your new superstar producer.
Precisely.
Fantastic. So the United States have retained the President's Cup with a huge 12.5 win over the international team. The U.S. led 11-7 overnight and needed 15.5 points for a victory. Jordan Spieth, Patrick Cantlay, and Tony Finau all won their single matches, but it was Xander Schauffele who hold the winning putt for the U.S. team. Let's hear the moment when he hold that putt to win the President's Cup for the U.S.
And it's Xander Schauffele who delivers the last decisive point as the U.S. wins the President's Cup for the 12th time in 14 contests. It's ninth in a row.
Yeah, they have dominated this tournament, have the U.S.
Yes.
So they've played 14 of them altogether so far. The USA have won 12 of them. The international team have won one, and one has ended in a tie. So I don't know what the future of this particular tournament holds. You don't like to see a one-sided event.
No,
right?
It's boring.
Yeah, it's boring.
In fact, what was so much fun about the tennis was that normally the Europeans have been winning.
Yes, exactly.
What's it called? The
Laver Cup.
The Laver Cup.
Yeah, there you go.
And then this year, it was actually the Americans for the first time because we're seeing
a
changing of the guard.
There you go. Yeah. Changing of the guard over in the tennis.
My husband talked about that this morning, by the way. That's why I know. Yeah.
although, were you watching when Federer played his last match on Friday?
No, but I have seen them all cry afterwards.
Nadal
crying, saying half my, what did he say? Something like half my tennis has been,
career has been playing against you. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, really lovely.
Two grown men crying on a tennis court. That's what we were watching on Friday. Yeah.
Nothing like that.
Heartbreaking.
I can't think of a better Friday night, actually. But then I'm married. Mohammed Salaman, as always, a pleasure to have you in the studio. News is next, and we are late for it. So I'm going to say thank you and goodbye.
Thank you, Georgia.
Now, more than 300 world-leading experts are due in Dubai this week for the Dubai Metaverse Assembly at the Museum of the Future. More than 40 specialised international institutions are also due to attend, with the aim to utilise the current metaverse technologies and to improve the global readiness within several key sectors. To find out more about what we can expect, I'm delighted to be joined by the director of the Dubai Metaverse Assembly, Hamad Al-Shirawi. Hello, Hamad. How are you?
Hi, Georgia.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's a pleasure to see you in person. I always wonder whether, when we do these metaverse things, whether one day I'm going to be presented with an avatar. So it's good to see you in person on Teams. Tell me what the Dubai Metaverse Assembly is and the aims that you have over this week.
Absolutely. So under the patronage of His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the Crown Prince of Dubai, Chairman of the Executive Council and Chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Dubai Future Foundation, the Dubai Metaverse Assembly aims to bring together 300 of global experts, industry experts, policymakers, innovators, startups, government departments and institutions, ultimately to look at ways how to capitalize on the metaverse, how to foster this advanced technology, and how to explore its impact on our economy and how we do things.
So my understanding is that it's one of the first big conferences on the metaverse, and needless to say, it's being held in Dubai, and needless to say, it's being held at the Museum of the Future. When did you guys come up with the idea for this assembly?
Georgia, you're absolutely right. This is the first event of its kind in the region. So I'm not sure if you recall, but around 2 months ago, His Highness announced the Dubai Metaverse Strategy, which looks at different angles. And you know, where else other than Dubai does a city or an emirate capitalize on advanced technology and adopts them and capitalizes on them? So what makes the metaverse any different? So if you look at the metaverse strategy, you know, there are kind of, you know, a few points from the strategy. You know, one, obviously, it aims to make Dubai amongst the top 10 cities for the metaverse technology. But then also looking at the future by 2030, the strategy aims to make Dubai to double its current number of blockchain entities. So Dubai currently has around 1,000 blockchain establishments. We wanted to multiply that by five. We also wanted to add around 40,000 virtual jobs by 2030, as well as add $4 billion to the Emirate of Dubai's economy through the metaverse. So the assembly is that first gathering to complement the efforts of the strategy to bring these experts in one place, foster synergies, look at ways that, you know, the government sector and the private sector can actually capitalize, and your day-to-day startup or innovator can actually capitalize on this technology.
I think it's very important that you do host an assembly of this sort, because I have to say, I think there's a lot of people who, including, and I definitely do include myself in that number, who don't really get it, because I've done quite a few metaverse interviews with people to try and get to the bottom of it. And it's still, I think, although I understand the principles of it, I still don't understand the point of it. I think that's the sort of fundamental. So in many ways, I imagine that the assembly is going to push the metaverse sort of forward, not just economically, not just in the eyes of people who understand it, but also for people who sort of don't get it.
Absolutely. So, you know, the assembly has, you know, maybe if I can maybe explain, and, you know, obviously, Georgia, you're maybe one of the people that we try to obviously reach out as part of the audience of this event. If you look at it, the assembly takes place on the 28th and 29th of September, so literally after tomorrow and the day after, and it has kind of three different components or three different tracks. The first track is the educate track, which aims to ultimately demystify, deep dive within the metaverse, looking at various topics like governance of the metaverse, virtual real estate, the entertainment and gaming industry, and, you know, bringing in some of, you know, world-renowned speakers. We'll have over 30 speakers. The second track is the experience track. So we will have around 9 immersive metaverse experiences here in Area 2071 in Emirates Towers. And then the third track, which is the contribute track, which are these invite-only workshops where entities like Accenture, like Meta, like the World Economic Forum are looking at the metaverse and our specific components within the metaverse and how they can advance that component and how they can tackle the challenges that impede it. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, how, you know, this is something that you like to understand or understand what it means for you or what it means for the various sectors, this is absolutely important. There are countless examples. I could name some of, you know, I can't maybe name the names. I don't want to ruin it for our speakers, but you have some amazing speakers at the event, entities that are honestly revolutionizing the way they do business. You have entities that are training and conducting capacity building for their employees around the world, over 100,000 employees completely through the metaverse. And then you have other entities that are based locally, but are also global entities or corporates that are revolutionizing the way they do business. So they're advancing their current offerings through the metaverse, where you'll be able to see pieces, try them out, shop, experience, and have something delivered to you completely through the metaverse. So it's completely revolutionizing the way business is done.
Okay, so can anyone come down, or do you have to get tickets, or can you watch it online if you're not allowed to come down?
So see, there's kind of two parts. You know, obviously, we have limited seats. We'll have around 300 plus of these industry experts and thought leaders at the event. But there will be live stream, and there will be ways to actually experience this in a very immersive way online.
Fantastic. Now, I mean, my final question is sort of an overarching one. You know, to what extent, if you're looking ahead at this, you know, you're hosting the first Dubai Metaverse Assembly, you're looking ahead, to what extent do you think the metaverse is going to impact our daily lives? Is it going to be, in 5 or 10 years' time, are we going to say metaverse in the same way as we say internet now?
See, Georgia, the metaverse is already shaping things. It's just a matter of time that it starts growing. So countries and business are already looking at the metaverse. You have very well-known big tech institutions that are already capitalizing on the metaverse. It's already reshaping the way business is conducted. Like I said, retail is already being reshaped. You have global brands, which I'm sure you've seen headlines that are, you know, building shops and retail experiences in the metaverse. Virtual real estate is massive. The NFT market on its own in the past year, you know, there's been over $40 billion worth of transactions. You have the education sector also that's also looking at the metaverse as an opportunity to deep dive even further. Through research, you'll be able to see things more closer. You'll be, you know, more immersive. You know, what makes the metaverse different than the other technologies is that, you know, there are multiple users, multiple developers, multiple creators all in one place and being quite immersive. And it's not limited to just, you know, individuals with VR headsets or certain equipment. You know, you'll be able to actually experience the metaverse through smartphones, through the internet as well.
Absolutely fascinating. You've almost persuaded me. I'm genuinely interested by it. And I think I got that slight sort of Luddite attitude towards it, where if you can't understand it, you sort of think, no, I'm just not going to engage. But I've got to persuade myself. So thank you very much indeed, as ever, Hamad Al-Sharawi. Thank you very much for your time, Director of the Dubai Metaverse Assembly, which is taking place this week. If you can come up with a really simple explanation for the metaverse, by all means, take the test and send it in, 4001, or you can message just 0487155500. But thank you very much there to Hamad Al-Sharawi. Hello there, welcome back to the show. It is 10:54. Now, banks in Lebanon are reopening after a week-long closure that came after several lenders were stormed by customers trying to retrieve their trapped savings. Sally Hafez, who held up a bank branch with a toy gun in Beirut's Sadoukho neighbourhood on September the 14th, actually managed to get $13,000 after her savings out of her savings. Have a listen to this. This is her speaking after the event.
I entered the bank. What happened, you saw it. We closed the door. I cocked the guard, even though I did not intend to use it. But when I saw the operation failing, that they noticed the man and started pushing him, I remember used it and started throwing fuel. Of course, the manager, who the day before was showing off and not paying attention to me, started telling me whatever you want, because nothing works but like this. We're in a country of mafias. If you are not a wolf, the wolves will eat you.
The customer attacks come after banks imposed informal capital controls in the financial crisis of 2019, which severely restricted access to hard currency. The Lebanese pound has since lost more than 90% of its value, and the country is experiencing, as we all know, severe shortages of basic essentials, including bread, electricity, medicine and water. Joining us live now to cover this story from Beirut is journalist Wael Taleb. Thank you so much for joining us on Teams. How are you, Wael?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Now, I understand that there were several bank raids. Was it the case that every time people were just trying to get their own money out?
Yes, from the latest the bank raids, most of them were people who had their money in the banks. And most of them, they had the emergency cases, like their family members. They had to pay for their medical bills or something similar.
Have they been charged for their heists?
They have not been charged. There were attempts, but they have been released shortly after their arrest.
That's really interesting. And is that symptomatic of the way that people in Lebanon feel about these raids?
For sure. I mean, people in Lebanon, most of the people in Lebanon, they have deposits still stuck in Bas. So they can relate to the people doing these things. And the people doing these operations, they are not usually violent people. They are saying after they do the operations, we hate violence. They are using toy guns oftentimes.
I mean, we've been covering the story in Lebanon, as you can imagine, for years now. And the situation on the ground seems to be fairly static. It's not good, but it doesn't seem to be getting worse, or at least not dramatically worse. Is that the case as you perceive it now? You know, has the price of bread remained more or less static for some time? You know, has the electricity situation remained the same, slightly dodgy for a certain amount of time?
I mean, it depends how you measure it. Yes, you have a far minority of the population who earn their salaries in dollars. So whatever the lira, how much the lira loses its value, they're not going to be affected. But the majority of the population's salaries are in liras. So no, it is getting worse for these people, as far as I understand.
I mean, symptomatic of the crisis is this tragic story about the sinking of a migrant boat off the Syrian coast. 94 people died in that situation. Are more and more people trying to flee the country?
Yes, I think the recorded cases are not reflective of the actual number of boats who are attempting to travel. We only hear about the boats who get stopped from traveling. So yes, because of the situation, as you mentioned, the lira lost its value, Lebanon sectors are collapsing. Tripoli is one of the poorest cities in the Mediterranean, and maybe the poorest city in Lebanon. So yes, people are desperate. They travel with their families, they die with their families. There was a story today about a Palestinian passenger who was on board with his wife, and it was not his first attempt to travel.
Is there any hope in sight? Is there a deal with the IMF? Is there any suggestion that a new government will be formed and that progress will be made?
I mean, the solution is easy. Yes, the Lebanese government should do a deal with the IMF, which would unlock more than $3 billion, which is promised by the IMF, which will, as far as I understand, would unlock more cash. But the Lebanese government's intention so far has not been serious about implementing these reforms that are demanded by the IMF. So far, they implemented zero of the reforms demanded by them.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your update there on the situation on the ground in Lebanon. Really, really appreciate your time. Journalist Wael Taleb there, a journalist in Beirut, giving us an update on the situation.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Hello there. Welcome back to the programme. Georgia Tolley here, of course, alongside producer Andrew Hosey, who has been very busy this morning, haven't you, Andrew?
I have indeed. I've been following the Minister of Health and Prevention presser this morning on the seasonal flu campaign. They do this every year. They've launched this year's campaign this morning. And joining us now is Dr. Nada Al-Marzouki, the Director of the Department of Public Health and Prevention at the Ministry of Health and Prevention. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the line this afternoon, Dr. Nada.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for having us today.
So what was announced this morning?
Yeah, the Ministry of Health and Prevention has launched its seasonal flu awareness campaign. Usually that we launch in September every year with collaboration with all the health authorities to make sure that the community is aware about the starting of the season and the importance of taking the necessary measures to prevent the infection.
So in a nutshell, who should be getting this jab?
Well, the jab is available for everybody from 6 months old. However, we are usually targeting the highest vulnerable groups, and those are the children under 5 years of age, the pregnant ladies, the healthcare workers, the elderly, as well as those who have chronic diseases. That is why we encourage them all to seek and get the flu shot in the nearest health center.
So why is it so important for those, particularly the vulnerable, to get a flu jab?
Because usually those are the groups who are usually getting the severe complications of the disease. So instead of going into that and to prevent any consequences or death, God forbid, we encourage them to get the flu shots on a yearly basis.
Fantastic. Dr. Nada Al-Marzouki, Director of the Department of Public Health and Prevention at the Ministry of Health and Prevention. Thank you so much for joining us on the line this afternoon.
Brilliant to have Dr. Marzouki on the line. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.